This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
All right. Well, welcome everybody to the leanconstructionblog.com podcast. I'm Dick Beyer, and today we are joined by, for episode number 30, this is actually really, really timely, the only luminary that we haven't spoken to in the lean world that we have access to, Dr. Glenn Ballard. So, Dr. Ballard, great to see you, Glenn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am spectacular for an old guy. Thank you very much.
Well, I could make that amendment also.
I love that. Well, thanks for joining us. I mean, you are obviously one of the stars in a very small constellation of stars in the lean community. And you are, you know, fundamentally the founder, right there in that group of pioneers. That's why we kind of invented the Pioneer Award for you and Greg early on. And it's mostly lived up to its reputation, I think, over the years. So tell us a little bit about where you were raised, where you came from, how you were educated. I heard a story that you were a rodeo cowboy in South Texas one time, and that may not be true.
Well, that's almost true. I was raised on a ranch in Southeast Texas, the extreme Southeast corner. So if you went any further, another two steps, you'd be in the Gulf of Mexico. If you're going south, and if you're going east, you'd be in Louisiana. So, or in that part of the world, you'd say Louisiana.
And you'd be heading for jambalaya or something like that, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. Most of my classmates were French Canadian Cajuns. So
yeah, who there's a long story. I know a lot of Acadians up here, and the story of the deportation of the Acadians is quite a story for Canadians, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So you ended up. So were you born there, born and raised, or?
Yeah. Well, I was born near there, a little bit up in East Texas. I was born in Liberty, Texas, which is right on the Trinity River, and apparently it wasn't right where my family was living, but that was the closest hospital. So they were out in the country. They were all farmers and ranchers and agricultural people. So,
and you decided not to follow in their footsteps and to move on. I mean, you ended up going to St. John's in
Santa Fe,
right?
Yep. Yeah, I had gone for a year commuting from home to a nearby Texas State University, Lamar State College of Technology, I think it was called. And at the end of that, I said, you know, I can read books, and I don't think I'm getting anything more than that from being in this university. And so I decided to immigrate to Australia and homestead a horse ranch.
Wow.
Yeah. And I almost did, but I was at the time had a subscription to a magazine called Saturday Review. And they ran an article on St. John's College and this new campus in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it was to my knowledge, it was the first time a university opened a spatially separate campus, you know, at a distance. So the first one is in Maryland, Annapolis, Maryland. It's the third oldest college in the United States.
So, wow. Well, I was born in Laurel, Maryland.
I went there because it sounded like, from that article, it sounded like what I thought university was supposed to be. And it's a completely all required curriculum. It was formed by some gentlemen who had been seduced by the Great Books program at Oxford University in the UK. And they said, well, let's replicate that at St. John's. And they did it, but with one addition. That is the addition of, so it has a seminar that runs through all 4 years where you talk, you read, and you read the originals about, you know, we started with the Iliad, for example.
Right.
And then went all the way up to, I don't know, something much more recent. And then there was mathematics. Okay, we started with Euclid's Elements and Ptolemy's Almagest, and then worked our way up to Lobachevsky's new non-Euclidean geometries and so forth. And there was a language tutorial in which we weren't trying to learn the language. We were using a foreign language as a foil to really better understand language as such, right? And so the foil in the first 2 years was classical Greek, and then the third and fourth French. Okay? And what they did was a whole laboratory sciences all 4 years. Okay. So we went from kind of constructing a slide rule when people use slide rules by making one up, and all the way to Einstein.
That's fantastic. I actually thought about going to St. John's. I ended up going to Middlebury just so I could feel what it was like to be really cold for a very long time. but that's a really interesting trajectory. There is a guy here, his name is, I think it's Joseph, but it's Mr. Smith, who just gave $100 million to Queen's University for their engineering program to try to bring humanities into the engineering program. Because he felt like engineers were just, they were too A plus B is C, and they couldn't quote Shakespeare and never read a book. And, you know, they get very analytical and they lose that cerebral quality that the humanities actually brings to you. So you didn't go to St. John's to get a job.
No. But I got a job. I got a job offered from St. Mary's College in Moraga, California, outside of San Francisco.
Great basketball program, by the way.
I'm sorry. Yep. Yep. They've had a good basketball program for a long time, but
they've been the chief Gonzaga in the world.
It's really small, place. So you have, there's a definite home court advantage.
It's fantastic.
They had a program, partly a small program within the larger college, that was modeled on the St. John's program. And needed someone to teach, and I said yes. So that moved from Santa Fe. So I'd gone from East Texas to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to Moraga, California.
So the climate was getting increasingly better at every step.
Indeed. Although Mexico, I really fell in love with New Mexico.
Santa Fe is a beautiful spot, and New Mexico itself is. I mean, I'm a Colorado boy, so I grew up in Denver, and we went to northern New Mexico all the time. And my grandmother's sister, my great aunt, emigrated to Santa Fe as an electrolysist to celebrities. And she ended up doing some great art collecting and different things from the Tao school back in the 40s. And so we had a lot of really interesting artwork in our house from that northern New Mexico.
That's nice.
Action. Yeah. So you went to Moraga, and at St. Mary's, what did you teach?
I taught within that program. I taught a variety of things. I taught Newton, mainly Newton, and it was the science piece of it. In the third year, and I taught mathematics in various years. I was there for 7 years, or I think.
Wow.
So I taught pretty much everything.
So somehow, somewhere along the line, I remember that you were at Bechtel when you first met Greg Howell. So how did you get from St. John's to St. Mary's to?
Well, I got laid off. That's what happened. Well, I was having so much fun. I had foolishly not taken the precaution of studying in advance, getting an advanced degree. And so, when they had a crunch in enrollment, they laid me off. And it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I went with my new wife, I went to back to Houston, and I got a job at a summer job as a pipe fitter's helper, with Brown and Root, not with Bechtel. Okay. Not yet.
Brown and Root. Right.
And I loved it from the moment I got there. I mean, I loved working outside. I loved working with my hands. I love being able to see the almost immediately the product of your labors. And I really enjoyed the people that I worked with. So,
wow.
But nice. They didn't let me do that very, very long. I was put into construction engineering, and that's where I met Greg. And it was on a project with, it was an olefins unit, petrochemicals unit, was a joint venture of Conoco and Monsanto. And they fought like dogs and cats, the owners. And that caused all kind of trouble, and we probably didn't help. And so there had been two changes of the Brown and Root project manager. And the third change brought in this guy named Howard Peak. And he had never been a project manager. He was the outside boundary limits OSBL project superintendent at the time. But he and I became really good friends, and I got picked in a crazy thing that Greg Howell could only tell appropriately to be the coordinator for a group of consultants that Howard brought back from a University of Texas Construction Productivity Improvement Conference. This was like 1979, and we were about 6 months away from scheduled completion. We were way over budget and way under time, right? And so we did a productivity, we did a work improvement program. And it worked. And we wound up, that project accomplishment wound up on the cover of Engineering News Record.
Wow. Was that the only time you were on the cover of Engineering News Record?
I think so.
It's too bad. I know Will was
that's
on
where
it
I met
time.
Greg. I met Greg, and Mike Kasten was also on that project. I think your viewers know him. We later worked on a project together in Venezuela, which Mike may have mentioned. I'm not sure, but it was called PARC, Proyecto Arcuación Refinería Cardón, and it was in the only stinking desert in Venezuela.
Wow. Who would have guessed there's a desert in Venezuela, right?
Well, it's kind of a peninsula, and it's sticking out into the ocean, and something prevents things from growing in the sand.
Okay.
So, but we were on that project. They had to improve productivity because they had 10,000 workers on the site. They were in similar situation to the one that I just described. Within a year from schedule completion, way over budget and way running out of time. And there were the accountants, the project accountants calculated that in order to bring it in on time, they needed 8,000 additional workers. And there were not 8,000 additional workers available who could both walk and chew gum at the same time. So
this was a project, wasn't it, where you guys walked around and you said, there's all these kinds of people wandering around the project and they don't even have like a 2x4 in their hands. And the next day, everybody's wandering around the project with a 2x4 in their hands, which doubled down on the lack of productivity.
I think that was the Greg story.
Now all the 2x4s are missing, right? So. So this is really interesting because you obviously were intrigued by these problems, but you didn't have some advanced engineering degree someplace that would say, well, here's how you apply, you know, these principles to productivity. So you kind of had to think of it almost raw, right, out of the box. In that sense, you kind of had to invent what was the problem and what's the solution.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Around that time, productivity improvement conference I presented a paper called crew level planning. And if you want to see the early seedbed for the last planner system, read that paper.
Wow.
So you were published in the Lean Construction Journal.
So when did you start writing papers and deciding that I'm going to tackle these problems and then I'm going to write about it? When did you, was that part of kind of being an academic or?
I didn't have the academic background, so I didn't really think about, I don't think I really learned how to write academic papers until I got my PhD. And that was a good reason to get it.
Yeah. And that put you through the hoops.
Exactly.
But it's obviously that, I mean, it seems obvious to me, and hopefully it's obvious to people that are watching this and know you and know about your career, and that you just began to look at things and went, you know, that's odd. Why do they do that? Why wouldn't we try this thing? And then
good company. I had met Greg Howell and Mike Castron. Both are, you know, guys that think out of the box and outside the box. And so that was good company, you know, to start from. And but I did, and I kept getting thrown into situations where I was free to, and it was important to solve problems, right? And so,
what was your kind of a, was there a problem solving methodology? I mean, people talk about that, you know, all the time, and talk about, well, you need to do this process, you need to do that process, and or was it just kind of, you know, it starts with the five whys and you just go from there?
Yeah, it wasn't very structured, I don't think. I mean, but I have taken away and used forever some things I learned in that first project. That it was that Olefins Unit, Chocolate Bayou Project is what it was called. And one was to, and I've used it every place I've been, is go talk to the people doing the work, right? And so, I mean, I can tell you later, I moved back to the San Francisco area and joined Bechtel in 1982, I think. Yeah. But in that intervening 2 years between the Chocolate Bayou Project and going to Bechtel, I was the manager of productivity improvement for one of Brown & Root's construction divisions. And in my first complete year, we improved productivity by 10%. And this was in, the division was responsible for, they had changed the, they found out that their different construction divisions were competing with one another, and that didn't seem reasonable. And so the one I was with, even though we had been doing oil and gas, we started doing just forest products. So, pulp and paper.
Oh, okay.
So I was responsible. I had staff on every pulp and paper project in design and construction for Brown & Root in the United States. So
I mean, it's really amazing that you're laid off from your job, you get in your car, you go to Houston with your new wife, you are doing an internship with Brown & Root, and within a year or two, you're the head of productivity for a segment of the company. That's a pretty meteoric rise.
Yeah. I like I say, I think I was blessed with people who were they weren't embarrassed that I didn't have much experience, as long as I was producing, delivering the goods.
Right. So when you tackle the productivity problem, I mean, when I think of productivity, because I've been in an awful lot of trailers where. Or site superintendents think of productivity as making people do work faster rather than doing work better. But I think the two components of it is trying to get to that kind of perfect, you know, tact about how long it takes to do something and make sure that you're focused on getting that done. But it's also taking the space out between the other work or the other things that you do so you can concentrate on your work. And so when you were thinking about this stuff afresh, how did you focus on, you know, where the issues were, where the problems were? Because Greg had just come from this, you know, wonderful stint with Henry Parker and doing his slow-mo, you know, work framing and saying, oh, it's the framer. And I'd go down and help the framer. And then that backlog would just get pushed forward. And he goes, I'm not helping the project very much. I mean, the framer really productive, but that didn't help the overall project. So how did you tackle it? What were you looking for? And what did you see?
Well, ultimately, I was looking for flow, as you're suggesting, right? And so I would start by looking for interruptions to flow, right? And I think I didn't understand right away, but I came to understand that you really needed to have a structure like the Last Planner system in order to facilitate flow, right? And because otherwise, it's just push, 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 right?
Right.
So one of the things that I did with Greg on the Chocolate Bayou project was Craftsman questionnaires, delay questionnaires. So we would just ask people, well, what's keeping you from doing your work? How much time do you lose? Right? And we have time for a story.
Of course. We got all day, my friend. Out, right? Not to worry.
Okay. So then this is with Greg. So one of the things that was, when we did the first survey, one of the many things that craft workers told us was that they, half the time they went to the tool room, we had 5 tool rooms, 2,000 people on site. And so they were scattered around, you know, the footprint of the plant. And they said that half the time they went to get something, a tool or some type of, hell, a rag or a pencil, right? Whatever. They didn't get it. And so we went into Howard Peak. Remember, he's the new project manager. And we said, Howard, da 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 da. And Howard elevated. And he was a tall guy. He got taller. And he said, that bullshit can't possibly be true. I've spent $3 million on small tools, and now you can't tell me that's the truth. And we said, well, don't shoot the messenger. Could we go talk to Billy, who's head of the superintendent over the warehouse, and he's responsible for the tool rooms? He says, and not only do I allow it, I insist that you get there, and I'm calling right now and tell him, stand up, you're on your way. And as we're walking out the door, Greg turns back and says, well, Howard, you know, there must be some turndowns. What percentage out of 100 do you think it might be? And Howard says, I can't believe it's more than 1 or 3, 1 or 2, something like that. Just, it's all very small. Okay, check, right? And we go talk to whatever his name was. And the same thing plays out, absolutely the same thing. And as we're going out, we say, well, what do you think? Dot, dot, dot. And he said, I don't remember the exact numbers. It's written down somewhere, but it was maybe 10%, okay? And we said, well, can we talk to Wally, the general foreman, over the tool rooms? Yeah. And go do it. Did it. Wally said, I think he's at 20%. Okay. And then we go to, he said to Wally, can we go to talk to a tool room attendant? Right. We're trying to get closer to the problem, right?
Right.
And we do. And we asked, well, what do you think the turndown rate is? He says, well, I haven't actually tracked it, but I think it might be, you know, maybe 25 or 30% because we're having a real shortage in grinder discs, right? Okay. So we say, do you mind if one of us sits here and counts? He says, no, go ahead. Get after it, right? Well, his boss told him to treat us well, right?
Right.
Greg drew that straw, and he counted, and the craft people weren't right. It wasn't 50%. It was 47.
Wow.
Now, it turned out that was a little bit skewed because it was during the day as opposed to at the beginning of the day, right? But it did reveal that there was a lot of hoarding going on, and hoarding is driven by an experience of not having something when you need it, right?
Right.
And so the gang boxes tend to get filled up with everything you might need, even though you don't need it now. And that means you can't have enough.
Right. And system unreliability sparks that.
Exactly.
You just don't trust it. So you start, it's funny because that's how my wall of wine got developed during COVID. Because I just wasn't sure that I would get another delivery. So I stacked it up, and before I knew it, I had, you know, 85 bottles of wine or something just to make sure, you know, that in this period of time.
Hopefully they were long aging.
Yes, they were. Some of them are still there, as a matter of fact. So that's interesting. So you took that work, and I mean, as you get closer to the work, you find out more and more of the truth, right? This is the essential part.
That's the point we took away from that one. And it was literally true in that case, and it seems from my subsequent experience to be generally true that the further away you are from the direct work, the less you know about what's going on there. And that's not a necessary truth, right? But it tends to be very common.
Yeah. Well, it seems to be exactly what I see in my experience as well. And it's funny because the guy who's running things, Howard thought he was completely on top of it because he had people reporting to him. And he was overseeing what needed to be done. And he was able to report that, you know, everything's fine when the ship is sinking.
Gurgle, gurgle.
So now I'm beginning to see the start of a last planner kind of, you know, we need to go ask the guys that are doing the work, you know, what work they think they're doing.
Well, I wanted that to be the last defense, right?
Right.
So it seemed to me that if you really wanted to, so we wanted to build it backwards, if you will. If we can know that we're not assigning work to be done and it's not being done just because it's in the schedule, right, or somebody's crazy idea, then we can work backwards to make sure that what we do want to have done, we have everything we need to do it, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, if there was ever a system that was set up to be completely divorced from reality, it's the way that we schedule construction projects, right?
I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. And it's, I remember even at that time on that Chocolate Bayou project, I keep going back to it because it's kind of formative of my thinking. I was an area engineer, right? One of three. And we would get these boxes of computer printouts, and there was no instruction about what to do with them. And so they just piled up, right? And then I decided I was going to look at one day, and I couldn't make heads or tails out of it. And as far as I could tell, it had absolutely no connection with what we were doing in the field.
So, but somebody was being paid to do it. And yeah. That, you know, and that kind of reminds me, Driscoll showed up in Iraq, and he found out that all its really interesting information were stuck in pouches in a closet because nobody knew where to send it, whether it was the NSA or the CIA. So they just, you know, just threw it in the closet. It's kind of the reverse of that, right? That the deep into that schedule printout someplace might have been a kernel of knowledge that somebody could have pulled out, but who knows?
Yeah. The problem with the approach to scheduling is it really is driven by the idea of optimization, right? And that so the claim is that the presupposition, at any rate, is that you can determine months, maybe years in advance to the day exactly what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Without in basically no other reliance than on command, right?
The real presupposition to that is that everything will be ready to go in perfectly on time, right? That everything will be at your disposal when you need it, and people will work as you have programmed the work, even though that program of work that's stuck in the schedule is full of unseen buffer anyway.
Well, and unseen assumptions, right? Not unstated assumptions. And you couldn't, you'd have to have a book with your schedule in order to understand all the assumptions that are implicit in it. But my thinking, as my experience has led me to really think that, you know, looking back to what your original plan was is almost useless, right?
Right.
What you want to be doing is looking forward to where you're going to go from where you are.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Let's plan to complete, not plan to repair.
And plan to release as well, right? I mean, just keep things moving. I think it was Mike Tyson that said, everybody has a plan until you get hit in the face. And that is like hour one on a construction project. Exactly. I mean, it doesn't take long for your schedule to get out of whack. And it's funny because I was on a project with Mark Concher down in Florida on a Balfour project for a big entertainment center in Orlando. Mm-hmm. And they had a guy who had been a project management kind of PMBOK guy, who was the head of buildings for the city of Orlando. And I think he'd been with URS or somebody. And he used to come over to the project with the schedule, and he would do a red line on this day. And he said, well, let's walk the schedule and see if any of this work's being done. And of course, invariably, either the work was done or it wasn't done. And it had nothing to do with the schedule. All things that were happening on the job were completely unrelated to his red line. And it got him so frustrated. He said, how could this be the world that we operate in? And it sounds like your story about Howard elevating himself, you know, going, oh my God, how could that possibly be true?
Right.
And the reality is that we have divorced ourselves from how the work actually gets done.
Right. And so it's not, I mean, to accept the fact that that our ability to predict the future is limited, right? Doesn't mean we can't do anything, right?
Right.
I think there's a lot that can be done, but you have to be more nimble and take advantage of, you have to wake up all your sensors, and the people in different positions in the job are your sensors, right?
Right.
But if you think that it's going to work just because you've given an order, made a statement of demand, which is what the schedule is, right? Then you're just crazy.
It never, in fact, never happens. So you're working with Brown and Ruth, and then you move to Bechtel, and you're now in a kind of engineering classification, without actually being an engineer, right? At the time, you weren't.
Right.
But they would in Canada, it's easy to tell engineers because they get a little ring that they put on their pinky finger. That reminds them of a failed bridge structure. So they're always thinking about,
oh, yeah. You
know, supposed to be a piece of that failed bridge.
Sober. So
it's quite a fraternity or sorority, depending on, you know, where you graduate. So how did you start to migrate into an engineering degree? Did you, at some point, I think, don't you have to get a master's before you can get a PhD, or it's all part of the process?
I had a master's. I had an MBA in production, operations management. Yeah.
Nice. And where'd you get that?
It was funded by Bechtel, and I chose a place called Holy Names College. This is right down. I could almost hit it with a rock if I had a really good arm from my home.
And, so you and the Pope you and the Jesuits happen to be very well connected between St. John's and St. Mary's and Holy Names.
I know. Yeah.
It's that Jesuit liturgy of education and strong, you know, moving people forward. At least that was the good part of the Jesuits, right? That's the sensible part. Okay, so you're now at Bechtel, and I'm assuming you're keeping your relationships up with Greg and with Mike Kasten and Howard and some of these people that you met.
Well, Greg, because Greg was on the West Coast, and I think he had something to do with me coming to Bechtel, you know, being offered that job. I think they asked him to do it, and he said, turned it down, but he said, but Ballard might. So
he ended up at Bechtel, which was one of the great opaque companies of the world that had started as the 29 companies on the Hoover Dam, right? Hmm. It hadn't been that creation, I think, of an amalgamation of people who said, hey, we worked pretty well on the Hoover Dam. Why don't we go do other big projects in the world?
Yeah.
And so what was your
assignment? That was a good 5 years or something like that that I was with them. I started on Chevron's Richmond lube oil project in Richmond, California, which is just on the bay.
Yeah.
Across from San Francisco. And we brought in that project at 15% below budget. And then subsequently, I was moved into the home office to work with the project as a whole, design and construction. And I began to learn a lot.
Awesome.
Yeah, and wanted just to say, just would say something about this this 15% thing. So there was a series of three projects at Arco Cherry Point up in Washington State, and the people that I had worked with in Richmond were doing those projects, and so they were using the same methods that we had developed and applied, and they had a similar experience in three successive projects. They reset the budget for the performance of the last one, and they improved it by 15%. They reset the budget to the performance of the last one. They improved it by 15%. So they were down somewhere around 60% of original cost. Right.
Wow. Yeah. I've taken that, I have this kind of fundamental belief that it takes a certain amount of money to build a project and a certain amount of time. And everything else is just, waste in the system that doesn't get you there. But it's remarkable how we think about these things as under budget when budgets are often comprised of contractual negotiations and not some really deep understanding of what the project is. So when you start having that kind of impact on projects, what kind of conclusions does that lead you to? Does it create for you a kind of paradigm for, wow, now this is how we have to attack projects?
Well, I didn't know any, I hadn't heard the term lean until I think I read the Machine That Changed the World, right? And but I think that what I was seeing was the truth that waste is not something, right? It's not like the excess inventory. It's not like underused capacity. It is the potential for improvement, right?
Right.
And the potential for improvement can take us a very long way. So we don't know. There's no natural cost to anything, right? Because the mind, and all the way from product design to process design and execution, can improve. So just trouble loose. Challenge is how do you organize so as to encourage people to learn constantly and forever.
It was funny. I was talking to the guys from Haley and Aldridge today, and they've come up with this kind of tool for analyzing a contractor's readiness or whatever. And they have 70 different things that owners would like to see in people. And one of them is a learning organization. And I said, I think I would take a learning organization over the other 69. But no matter how bad you are, if you're improving, I'd rather have you on my team.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Until you have those limits. So at some point in time, you met Todd Zabel and you met Iris and you met your international partners, Laurie Koskala and others, and you began thinking about something that you called lean, that you began to dub it as lean. Tell us a little bit about how that all came together.
Well, maybe I'll start with Todd. I met him when I gave the first talk I gave on the Last Planner system was in Santiago, Chile in 1992. And then the second one was in somewhere in the Bay Area in 1994. And Todd Zabel was in that audience. And when I asked the question of the audience, I'm trying to collect data on what's being done to improve planning. And I'd appreciate it if, I'll come talk to you, just raise your hand, give me a card. And the only person that spoke up was Todd Zabel.
Wow.
And so I went to work with them. And I worked with them at the Pacific Contracting. It was a buildings envelope company. And, not glamorous, but real work. And had a great time. So at one point I think we had worked together for a year, and he and I were looking at the numbers and the books and the profits and all that, and saying, well, what can we do to really go better, do better? We were doing pretty well, but we had both had the feeling that we were just, at the tip of the iceberg. And so we came up, and I don't know who's who I noted it, kind of simultaneous maybe, but we said we were working, our workers were union, belonged to a union. And I said, one of us said, or both of us said, you know, we can't pay them less than the union scale, but there's nothing that says we can't pay them more.
Right.
And so we cut the, we doubled their pay. We cut it first, we cut the workforce in half, and then double it. The ones that remained, we doubled their pay, and we quadrupled productivity.
Wow.
And profit.
Right. That's a nice little.
little
icing on the cake.
Okay, so that's how I met Todd. And then Iris, I didn't meet until, I think she came to Cal in 1996 or 7. And from Michigan, she had taught at University of Michigan previously. And that's when we met.
And you had put together, or you and your international friends had put together the IGLC prior to that, right? I think that was 91 or 92.
Yeah, I met Lowry, a colleague of mine at Cal had invited him. I don't know how he knew about it, but invited him to come over from Stanford, where he was doing a one-year SIFI study that turned out to be on the new production philosophy, which we adopted the term lean. And he came and he talked, and I talked to him after, and we started talking in 1993, that was 1991, I think. In 1993, we put together the first international group for lean construction meeting.
Wow. And how did you find like Sven Bertelsen and some of these other folks all around the world
those
were thinking about the same stuff you guys were thinking about?
Yeah. Just by, I'm not sure exactly how to say it. I think I signed Denmark to the first Lean Construction Institute outside of the United States.
Mm.
And then Sven was obviously a big mover and shaker in that community. So that's how we met.
So when you started the Lean Construction Institute, you and Greg, and I think Todd was part of that initially.
And Iris.
And Iris as well. Did that happen over a beer at Alice Waters' place in
No,
in
it
Berkeley,
takes it actually comes. It comes back to the Venezuela project in the Stinking Desert.
Oh, okay.
Now, this Greg and I never agreed about this. I think I thought about it. I thought up the idea, and he thought up the idea. But it doesn't really matter. Coming back from we succeeded at that project, and we delivered the project on schedule, with the exception of two project systems that the delay of which didn't have any financial impact on the client. So, and we also improved productivity by 28% in that last year. And we did it with, they had a really weird union, a political union, that if you brought somebody onto the project, you couldn't lay them off and then hire some other people of the same trade later, right?
So, wow.
So that's why they were up to 10,000 people.
Right.
half of them didn't have anything to do, but
it was funny that the solution to finishing the project on time that the accountants came up with was, you already have 10,000 people, 5,000 of which aren't doing anything, add another 8,000 people.
Then nothing will be done at all.
Yeah, so that will guarantee that nothing will be done, and it'll cost you a lot more money.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. So you came up with the idea of the Lean Construction Institute.
So on the way back, once we had kind of had the celebration in Venezuela with the client and everything, we were on the way back, and lubricated by a few alcoholic beverages, we started thinking about, well, what the hell are we, what's going on here now? We're on the edge of having repeat customers for saving bad projects. And is that how we want to live our life? Right? Is that what we want to do? So
right.
What we said was, it's obvious, and this was a string. I wrote them out. I have a list. There's a string of maybe 6 or 7 projects, of which this was one, that basically had the same look, taste and feel, right? They were failed projects, failing fast, and it looked like they were basket cases, but we brought them out, right? And so what we realized was that we knew we could do it, but right. we didn't know enough to make our clients able to do it without us. And so that's why we formed LCI. We said, we've got to figure this out. So we thought of LCI not as a recruiting program, but as a research project.
Right. So, as a think tank in some ways.
Exactly. That's exactly how we thought of it. Right.
And producing good work. So what LCI is today is not exactly what you imagined it would be, I take it.
Well, I'm not disappointed. I think they do good work, but I do think that, well, I've just recently given the same talk at the IGLC conference in France in June, and then at the LCI conference at USA Congress in Detroit a couple of weeks ago. And that was on the future of lean construction. And I'm challenging the industry to recognize, first of all, that the objective is the global construction industry, the lean transformation of the global construction industry. And that's what I've been working on for the last 30 years. And I think we need to get at it.
No, I think you must feel pretty good looking back and knowing that you've had a part in actually changing the way that we think about building buildings and facilities in the world, and you're actually changing the kind of construct of the built environment, which is pretty powerful. If you think about it, from a guy that was breaking horses in Southeast Texas to a guy who was reading 100 great books, and what a great career path. At some point, but I don't want to jump too far ahead in the story, because I do think that I know that the work that you were doing at Heathrow was, again, kind of a cast of characters that you were surrounded with, and another great opportunity with a great owner or a great program to say, wow, what can we do to do things better?
Yeah. What can you really do if you don't have obstacles, right?
Right.
Now, I actually worked with Todd in Strategic Project Solutions as the technical director on that project. And
oh,
then
wow.
subsequently
okay.
on the at St. Pancras Station in London on the Channel Tunnel Rail Link project, because they were changing the terminus station from Waterloo to St. Pancras. And so it had to be entirely revamped, and it's a historic building. So
it's a lovely building.
It's a lovely building. Yes, it
yeah.
is.
Yeah. It's got one of the great bars in the Western world. I can tell you that much. I love that place. So then you went. So what was your segue or your transition into Berkeley? Both teaching P2SL.
Well, I started as a lecturer and in 1989 at the wow. recommendation of some professors, civil engineering professors from Stanford that I had known through Greg. We'd been working together with them. And they were members of a peer review of that programs do, right?
Right.
And they said that it seems like you're not very strong in productivity and quality management. And we know the guy that can do that. So yeah. I got that job.
And were you, being a professor also allows you to do other things. So were you also working with Todd and teaching and doing
all of this was going on simultaneously.
Yeah.
So I was working with Todd. I was doing independent consulting. I was doing teaching, but I think, 2 days a week. So I couldn't travel very long. So,
right. So it was a constraint, as our friend Cold Rat would say. but from there, you've developed P2SL, which was a wonderful transition to bring industry into some of these academic things that you were thinking about? I mean, they were always looking for a crossover between who are the people that could actually do, if I think it up, who are the people that can go build that water organ or whatever it is?
Right. Yeah. That was with Iris. So Iris and I were the co-founders of P2SL. So I've had different partners in these different foundings, if you will.
Yeah, all these different ventures.
I don't know how well it's known, but one of the things that I'm most proud of about P2SL in the early days was that, you know, at around that time, it was formed in 2005. Right. And around that time, this was when the hospitals in California were really under the gun to meet a new state law about earthquake readiness or earthquake.
The OSHA transition.
Right. Yeah.
The Office of Hospital Safety and whatever that was.
Yeah.
OSHPAD. Not OSHA. Yeah. OSHPAD,
right. I can never remember what it stands for.
Yeah, but. Me neither. but I mean,
the state of California is one of few, maybe the only one, but maybe another one, who do not rely on certified engineers and architects in order to assure the designs of acute care hospitals. They have their own department that does that. As things started boiling up, right, it was pretty clear that OSHA just didn't have the staff to keep up. And so it was really difficult to get your permits, right, and your drawings reviewed and accepted in time to meet project schedules, right? And so people started, as you might expect, they started submitting earlier than they were before they were complete.
Right.
That made it worse.
Yeah.
and when we got, I don't remember exactly how we got involved in the problem, but I do remember hearing the statistic that in those days, it took, I think it took, it added 18 months to the schedule of an acute care hospital for that broken process, if you will.
Right.
And so what we did was we managed to get four of the major healthcare companies in the state to come together with OSHPAD. And we fortunately had a new appointee as the head of that department, that agency, and he was very open and willing to change and do whatever was necessary. And so we really got past that, you know, casting stones, blaming one another. And I remember we met in an empty building that had multiple rooms. So we had a big enough room to do everything in plenary session. And maybe it was 100 people there. So there were owners and there was architects and there were engineers and there were contractors and subcontractors. And right. So that we had a good representation. And what I had them do, and I was kind of the facilitator. And I had them, I handpicked four, one for each of those companies, four sub-lieutenants, let's just say, to lead the work mapping process in each of four separate rooms, right, outside of this one. I think, well, maybe we used that one, the plenary session, as one of those rooms. And then periodically, I would blow a whistle, and we would do a walkthrough, right? And I still remember somebody from one of the healthcare companies said, "You do what?" And so they started learning from each other right there, right? And just questioning, you know, it made them question things that they'd been, assumptions that they'd been making about how things had to be done. And it turned out that, and we started a series of meetings afterwards where people would come in and share what they were doing and what they were learning and applying those different processes that came out of those project delivery processes. And I remember at one point, Stanford came, the Stanford Medical Center people came to join just to attend one of those meetings. And they started, it sounded like you were going back a year and a half or something. And they were saying, well, if OshPod would only do, and OshPod didn't have to defend themselves. The other healthcare companies defended them. They said, okay, you are out of touch.
We can't be out of touch. We're Stanford, for God's sake.
Sorry.
Yeah. Time to wake up, take the night cap off.
At one point in that whole process, I took a straw poll of those four companies, and they said, our experience in acute care hospital projects is that we've taken a year out of that 18 months.
Wow.
So I think that's a contribution.
That's fantastic. Especially given that, you know, some people in the world may not know that OshPod was spawned by the Northridge earthquake that killed a number of people, and hospitals were shaken and they were out of service, and the promise or the goal was to keep a hospital operating independently for 2 weeks or a month or something after a significant seismic event. So you had water storage, you had backup power, you took every air handler,
different level of seismic engineering as well. Yeah.
And every air handler that was going to be installed in that hospital had to get on the shaker table. Mm-hmm. And they shook it for 10 minutes at Richter 7 or something. I mean, it was a very bold program.
It
got bogged down into some of the stuff that bureaucratic programs get stuck into, like the high-speed rail between LA and San Francisco. I mean, these things are mega projects that turn sour because they get kind of bureaucratized, but they're really good ideas.
Yeah.
So at P2SL, you started partnerships with other people in the industry, like construction companies. I remember DPR would send folks to P2SL and they'd send interns and people to be on the teams to study and learn how to do things. I think it was DPR. I don't remember who the...
Well, there were a number of such companies that didn't, and there still are. So, And we also, lasted years, actually, maybe 3 or 4 years. I did a study with DPR on their IPD projects.
Mm.
And that was very interesting because they had done the first acute care hospital for Sutter Health.
Okay.
Right. And so then they had done some more. So then there was also other people like UHS, Universal Health Services. It might not quite
Bill right. Seed and his team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They were doing
involved, right?
Yeah, but, trying to do interesting things.
Yep.
But Todd DeBell tells the story about you being at Heathrow, and I think it was Formers who were. Casting, maybe it was cast in place concrete guys or something, but there was a group of people that were doing some work and that you walked by and you kind of looked at it, and it wasn't necessarily your assignment, but you looked at it and you went, I'm curious as to why you do this. And within 2 weeks you had like quadrupled productivity by just one little step at a time.
I think that was actually, that might have been a different thing, but what it reminds me of is work we did prior to T5. Working with Lang O'Rourke, they had a wholly owned subsidiary called Malling's Concrete Products,
right?
And down in the place called Gray's, and boy, was it gray! Down further, further east on the Thames, and what we were doing was really getting them ready for T5 and for a different level of competition, if you will, right?
Sure.
And so my job, I was brought in by Todd to do it. And what we came up with was this idea of, so when we got there, when we started, this project was organized around trades, right? So you had a superintendent over concrete, over batching, over rebar, over welding, over placing and so forth. And so I don't know who came up with the idea, but I think it was me. So I came up, I said, well, why don't we use this idea of production cells? So where the cells are organized not around a family of products, close enough in their composition and design that you could treat them in the same process, right? Maybe with some adjustments occasionally. Right?
You'd have all the same skilled workers could work on
exactly, all
these different things.
Yep. So we didn't change anything about the crewing. We didn't change anything about the technology. And the only thing that the only money that was spent on change was I asked that they construct a shield to protect the workers from an acid bath. And that was about $30,000 or something. But that was it. But so I got to be good friends with the plant manager. And so before we started, I said, what was his name? Damn it. I'll call him Nick. It wasn't Nick. But I say, look, I want you to get together the plant mafia, the workforce mafia. And we need to talk to them, because if they're not for us, this won't work. Right. And he said, well, what are you talking about? And I said, these are the people in the project, regardless of their position, whose opinion is going to determine what people do. And so we identified six people, and some of them were supervised, some not, right? Some just, you know, direct workers, and brought them together and said, basically, I explained what we were going to do. And Nick said, well, you have a choice to do this and to help us figure out how to do it, but we have to do it. You have a voice, but you have no choice.
So you can either help us or you can go away.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they said we're saying that the whole organization was in peril, right?
Right.
We're stumbling along. I'll just cut to the chase. So, and I selected two product types, families of products, to do pilot tests on, pilot projects. And one was shear walls and the other was floor segments. And from records, I could determine, well, what was the average output throughput rate for those for a day previously? And for shear walls, it was 1.2 walls, I think it was. Couldn't have been that small. Maybe it was 2.1 or something. But at any rate, and then the other one was about, I think, damn, my memory's going. I can't remember. I think it was like eight floor sections. We had, and so I set it up so that there was, it was based on pull and a segue, but I think it's appropriate. So I'm walking with the plant manager through the project, and we spent a lot of time doing that. And I said, Nick, I'm going to try to say what you're looking at. He said, well, he was a little Welsh fire plug. And he used some expressions I knew were curse words, although I didn't understand them. And he said, well, how can you tell me what I'm looking at? I said, well, let me try. I said, you're looking at those hooks to see if they're loaded, and you're looking at those iron workers, fixers, to see if they're bending wire, right? He says, well, what else would I be looking at? I said, well, if you look at that stack, the place where the completed tied, what do you call them?
Mm-hmm. Sure, whatever.
Replaced, yeah. Say if there's one, at least one, but not no more than three, you don't have to worry about what you're looking at. It'll take care of itself.
Right.
So we encouraged using that kind of a mechanism We tripled productivity.
Wow.
Yep. We doubled it in the case of the floor segment because we only had 18 moles. So we could only double it.
Right. So you're really looking at the either the end of the line or the queue, and if it's empty, you're not productive enough. And if it's got 19 things there, you're in trouble.
Yeah, because something's stuck. Right?
Yeah. So that's really interesting. Look at the output, not the process necessarily, because the output will tell you there's a problem in the line.
Yeah. If you know how it's supposed to work, you can tell by looking at any place in it whether it's working. Right.
That's fantastic.
That simplifies.
So what are you doing now? What are you, you're supposed to be retired, supposedly, and I guess I'm supposed to be retired too, but not.
We're getting in the way.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Process of the world keeps getting in the way.
Well, I do things like this. I give talks. I'm just publishing a book along with a bunch of other people.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Target Value Delivery of Building Projects.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Who are your co-authors?
Well, my co-editor is, I think I haven't had enough to eat today or something. My brain isn't functioning. Is Peter Morris. Morris. I don't know if you know him, but he's a really good guy. And then I have people so one part of the book is devoted to five kind of cases that are written by people that operate in different positions in the industry. So I've got one from an owner, happens to be from Norway.
Yeah.
One from a cost consultant, it happens to be Peter. One from Bolt, one from DPR.
Is Peter at UC Davis?
Sorry?
Is Peter at UC Davis?
No, he's not an academic. He's a cost consultant for, he's now with AECOM.
Okay.
He's responsible for the Americas or something. So.
Gotcha. I love that idea. The Americas. Amerigo Vespucci would love that idea. So what's your passion? What do you want to do right now? What's the thing that you're really focused on because you feel like, wow, this is what I love doing?
Well, I'm torn. I'd really like to continue doing research and writing. But I think this initiative to really focus, to coordinate action of the different body, the lean construction bodies in the world, right, in pursuit of the same objective, and that's global transformation.
Right.
And so someone's got to do it, and I probably have self-selected.
So. You've certainly got the lean credentials, the academic credentials, the industry reputation, and the respect of people. So I'm sure it's not difficult to get somebody to answer a phone call.
Yeah.
I feel
like I'm kind of trying to try to impartially at least fill Greg's role as a connector. You know,
fantastic.
The things that he did so well, and
he was awesome. I mean, part of the reason for this podcast is because we lost one of the great storytellers out there, and we're collecting that story. I've been doing a lot of work up here with Indigenous people, and the importance of an oral tradition from elders is absolutely apparent to me. That's one of the things that I've been trying to do with the podcast is create this, you know, body of rich stories. Mm-hmm. And yours is one of the richest, my friend. So yeah. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
I appreciate you taking the time.
That's a noble effort.
Well, it's a good effort, and it's been great knowing you. It's funny, I told somebody today, yeah, I'm Glenn Ballard's joining me on the podcast. And he goes, oh, yeah, he's the guy that goes, every prediction is a forecast, and every forecast is wrong, and the longer the forecast, the wronger it is, right? And I went, That's the guy.
Well, I didn't make that up, I think, but it's true.
It has been attributed to you. So thank you so much for taking the time. Good luck with the journey out there. Let me know how I can help. We're always eager. And one of the nice things about being in Canada for the last 7 years, it's a more manageable space to try to really have an influence on 33 million people or 36 million people rather than 330 million people.
Right. Oh.
And it's a very homogeneous kind of industry. Everybody knows each other. And so it's an opportunity. So we'll have to get you up here. Carla Sipliski, just along with Farooz Hama, started a thing called Lean Design Construction Canada as a way of counteracting LCI Canada, that was a CCA, Canadian Contractors Association group. And they're really diving into a more, really trying to join the academic with the practical, like you and Iris did at P2SL, and make these learnings available. So we'll have to get you up here and have a stop with those folks.
Well, don't wait until it's too cold.
No, I'm going to wait till the summer. All right, my friend. So good to see you. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. Well. All right, Glenn. Thank you. You too. Good luck out there with that world transformation thing.
Well, you'll have a role.
I'm happy to help, man. Really happy to help. So thanks very much.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.